You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
I'm so hyped right now. Anything's possible.
Oh, my mama. Oh, my mama made it, ma. Anything's possible.
Rainy days, jump shot fade away. This the best Celtics podcast day to day. I get excited about it like when Tatum play a Jalen on the breakaway, a Kyrie when he make a trade, and nothing like the terrible analysts on the TV. So in depth that after you play it, you gotta repeat. So in depth they might do an hour about the D-League. So in depth you probably should pay him, but it's a freebie. Yeah, Corrales, Packard, and J. King. Locked on, trying to get the 18th ring. And well wishes go to Gordon. Listen, after every game is very important, Millie.
Hey there, welcome back to the Locked On Celtics podcast here on the Locked On Podcast Network. Thank you for making this part of your daily routine. We are here for you Monday through Friday, and today I, John Corrales, am continuing our series of interviews that get us through the All-Star break. We hope you have enjoyed the past couple. Michael Nye with his book and Dar Adams talking about basketball and music and hip-hop culture. Today, we are talking about the Larry Bird, Kevin McHale interview that aired Monday night on NBA TV. This was a must watch. So if you haven't seen it, search for it online because you have to as a Celtic fan. Even if you know their story, you just got to watch it. You just got to see it for the sake of being able to watch Larry and Kevin McHale talk basketball. But there's some really, really interesting stuff. And my guest tonight is Chad Finn from the Boston Globe, who wrote up a big piece about the interview. He got an advanced screening, so that was on Monday's Globe. Go check that out. We talked all about the whole interview from some of the revelations, like Larry Bird being nervous, the finger injury, the ends of their careers, Kevin and Larry, and just our favorite thing was the dynamic of the sheer depth of knowledge that was displayed by Larry Bird, and to hear him and to hear Kevin talk about that was just amazing. Chad and I talk about this. We had a nice long conversation, so that's coming up. I just want to implore all of you who are not subscribers, if you're just coming to the show for the first time, please subscribe to the podcast. Search for Locked On Celtics wherever you get your podcast and subscribe. We are here Monday through Friday all season long to give you Celtics knowledge from top to bottom. If you're just joining the show, I played a little bit professionally in Europe. So I definitely come at things from a player perspective. Jay King also played in college. He also is the Mass Live Celtics insider. So he gives us that perspective. And then, of course, there's Sam Packard, who just loves to get the jokes off, and he's really funny. So we have a nice little dynamic going. So you didn't get that on this show because it's just me and Chad, but check out past episodes, and we hope you subscribe. If you are a subscriber, please rate us 5 stars. We hope you enjoy the show. So without further ado, here's me and Chad Finn. All right, Chad. So we saw that hour-long discussion between Kevin McHale and Larry Bird, and I read your piece in the Globe on this, and I will just start out by agreeing with you. An hour was nowhere near enough.
No, it wasn't. And it's funny, I talked to McHale about it on Friday. The thing debuted Monday night, and talked to him, and he said, yeah, you know, the best stuff was really when we were playing golf or having a few beers or talking before and after. And I'm just thinking, man, if we just had a camera running during all of that too, you know, you could have had a 3-hour show instead of an hour.
It's just, I think the interesting thing for longtime observers of the Celtics is that, and they kind of addressed it in the program, there was always that talk about McHale and Bird didn't quite get along. You know, McHale was a little more gregarious. He was a little more outgoing. You know, he did the Cheers episodes and stuff like that. Bird was just basically, just leave me alone. I'm going to go home. I'm going to mow my lawn. And then that's it. You know, so it was interesting that they kind of talked about that a little bit. But you could see that there was nothing more than, I guess, like the regular, like they said, butting of heads in the, you know, in the course of playing you know, a decade plus with each other.
Yeah, like Mikhail said, I think he said it to me instead of in the interview, but 99.9% of the time, they got along famously. It just happened to be once in a while they would butt heads. You're having a bad day. Something goes wrong on the court. You know, you lose a random road game to the Sixers in 1986 or something like that. And then you get frustrated with each other. It was, their relationship was documented really well in Jack McCallum's book, Unfinished Business. I think it was Diary of the 91 season when things were starting to really shift, when Brian Shaw was here. It was D. Brown's rookie year, and the core guys from the great 80s teams were getting older. And he got into it a little bit in there. And basically the genesis of it was Bird thought Mikhail was a really awesome player and could have been even more awesome if he was as serious about everything as Bird was. Mikhail, just incredible player, worked hard, gave it his all on the court during the games, but away from it, he let it go. He didn't let it hang over him. He didn't let it affect his mood. He moved on to the next thing. He's probably joking about it 10 minutes later. And sometimes that drove Bird nuts because Bird was so laser focused on it. But when they had those 48 minutes together on the court, they were the same way. And I think that's what they remember now, all these years later, when they're in their late 50s and Larry's in his 60s now, and reminiscing about those days. It's they remember the good times above any little argument had here and there.
Man, that just hurt my feelings when you said Bird is in his 60s. Ugh.
He doesn't look it, at least.
No, he looks good. He looks good. He looks good. You know, I always say that, and I got to be careful nowadays how I say this, but the best of the best, the Birds, Jordan, Kobe, they have something in their brains that is, it doesn't work properly. And for them, it's to their benefit, because it's that thing that just drives them to be just better. There's always a thing like Magic, that famous thing. Like, they would take 300 shots because he knew Magic was out there doing the same thing. And it just drove him, where most people will sit there and not even like, I don't give a shit what Magic is doing right now. Like, oh yeah, Magic's working hard. I'm working hard too. That's good enough. But you know, guys like Jordan are still carrying grudges during his Hall of Fame speech from high school. Like, that's not right. That's not right. You know, these guys, and like you said, that's the difference between Bird and Mikhail. There's just like a slight, the thing that makes Bird just that slight bit ahead and makes him see things the way he sees things is just that there's like a screw loose. It's just something that, in a normal functioning brain where we have our balance and we don't let things get to us, he doesn't have that. It's not necessarily healthy, but it also is something that turns him into one of the top 5 or 10 basketball players of all time.
Yeah, they're basketball psychopaths, you know.
It really is.
Russell probably had the same thing. I think mm-hmm. Kyrie has it. You know, you look at who Kyrie is right now at his age and accomplishing with, now that he's got his own team to orchestrate. But you look back, how many players have hit a game-winning shot in the finals, in Game 7, on the road against one of the greatest teams of all time to win a championship? You've got to be a little bit beyond ballsy to be able to do that. You've got to have some mechanism in your brain that makes you think, you know what, I'm the greatest in this moment right now. And Larry, Michael, and Magic certainly had that all the time. I think we're still figuring out what this generation of players has. I think LeBron does. I think Steph Curry does, even though he seems like a really nice human being for the most part. I think they all have that killer instinct, or whatever you want to call it. And I think it's a defining thing between from being a great player to being somebody that is absolutely transcendent within the sport.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a different league now. Social media, not for better or for worse, it has changed the element, and you know, the player movement, the collective bargaining agreement that encourages player movement, the sharing of agents and sneaker deals, and it's just really changed things. And you could see, even look, the Larry and Magic is a great example of how something as simple as a common sneaker endorsement can change the dynamic between two players. Yeah. Because Larry and Magic, you can through their history, had an adversarial type of thing. They did play together on the national team at a very young age, but it was strictly business for Larry Bird. And it wasn't until they shot that Converse weapons commercial in Indiana that Magic got to sit down with Larry and his mom, and you get to sit there and you say, Larry, that's when Larry realized, like, oh, this is the exact same person. We're the exact same person from two different places,
right,
and we have just different personalities. Now everybody's got those common shoe deals. The shoe thing's a big deal, and it starts from such a young age that you can see, even from that old school scenario, that it's hard to like hate everybody like we always wanted to, you know, hate like we hated Lambeer, you know. So it's just interesting. Today's NBA, I think, is a little bit different.
Well, one of the things I really liked about that conversation was that these are two older guys who are really accomplished, and a lot of times when you see guys get to the age that they're at, they become bitter. They become territorial about their time and what the league was like when they were in it. Neither one of these guys are like that. Maybe because they've both been involved with the NBA in a couple significant capacities. They both were coaches. They both put teams together. So they, whatever you want to call it, but neither one of them is bitter. Both of them like the league right now. But the one thing that they both do lament is that teams don't hang out together like they used to, that you don't have that bond because you're traveling commercial. You're stuck in the airport at 2 a.m. together. You're all always, as I said, when they were talking about when they didn't get along, well, I lived with you for 12 years straight. Of course I need to get away from you. It's not like that now. The world is smaller, and the superstar who plays in Oakland can still be a good friend with the superstar who plays in Cleveland or Boston or wherever it happens to be. The league is tighter. The money is just so incredible that you tend to start to have loyalties, maybe not to the uniform you're wearing, but the sneaker company on your feet. So it's really changed significantly in that way. And I think it's made the community of the NBA closer, but the individual teams not as tight as they were in Magic and Larry and Mikhail's heydays.
Yeah, no, there's definitely a lot of that. I like the fact that you brought up the whole bitter thing. It contrasts nicely with the comments that Charles Barkley was making over the weekend. Charles Barkley is bitter, and he's exceptionally bitter. And I think it's kind of silly because he's upset at the schedule being changed to try to help prevent injuries. And when you look at, like, Barkley had injuries that might have been prevented if he had a different schedule. Mikhail certainly did. Everybody did. And he's so bitter about guys living the good life now. But this is just a product of what Larry, Mikhail, Barkley, Bird, I mean, MJ, all of those stars. This is a product of what they started to build. And he should be more proud of it than anything, in my opinion, that because of them growing the game to that point, that's what made it possible for these guys to have this. And I think going to kind of like the end of this episode, where Larry makes this amazing point to talk about how bitter he is not, yeah, that he loves this game. He loves the way the game has gone. And he just says that he hopes that these players can turn around and set things up for the next generation. You know, the stars of today, the big time, you know, today's versions of them, which would be, you know, LeBron and Durant and those guys, they need to kind of set the stage for the Jason Tatums of the world, the rookie class that comes in and say, hey, this is how you prepare yourself, and this is how, and just be happy for whatever part of NBA history that you're in, and just understand that you are setting the stage for the next generation, and hopefully they have it even better than you. It's a very parental way to look at it. Like, I want my kids to be better off than me. And I, as an NBA legend, want future NBA legends to be better off than me, because that means we've grown the game and we've done the game justice. And if they're not doing better than us, then that means the league's in trouble.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny because you see in the interview, there's so much great footage with this, and you hear Mikhail in the interview saying, when I was a coach or when I was running the Rockets or the Timberwolves, I would tell my players, if you ever see Larry Bird or Magic Johnson or David Stern, go shake their hand and thank them for what they got you, because they built this league. And then you see this clip of James Harden doing that. And
yeah,
James Harden is probably the reason Kevin McHale is no longer an NBA coach. And he also makes $50 million a year. So that's whatever he makes. So he's someone who should be damn appreciative. He should be shaking everybody's hand. But maybe it's a generational difference, but I like that McHale and Bird both have it still in context of how fortunate they were. McHale is a great story about when the Knicks were trying to sign him as a free agent in 83, he was real close to going there, and Red countered with a typical Red move and signed three of their players. And with the whole compensation situation, McHale ended up coming back. The Knicks did the wrong thing and kept their own guys. But McHale made $1 million a year then, and he was talking about how he came to camp after that, and you know, media questioned him about it, and some reporter asked him, well, how do you justify making $1 million a year? And you know, you can kind of bust on McHale a little bit with that kind of question, and he would just sort of laugh at it, and he thought about it, and he said, can't justify it. I make $1 million a year playing basketball when I used to, you know, shovel a driveway and ride my bike down to the rec center just to have a place to play every day. So I, you know, when I was making $200,000 as a rookie, and Bird says when he was making $650,000 early in his career, it was more money than they could ever imagine having. And now you have guys who, I think coming into the league, one of the appealing things about the league is they know they're going to hit a jackpot if they're a good player for a couple of years. Even on their first rookie deal, they're going to make a lot of money. So back in those days in the early and mid 80s, before the league had built up to what Bird and David Stern with his vision, I don't think you had players coming to the league thinking they were going to become super rich. Now you do.
Yeah. I mean, just look at Jason Tatum's contract. He's making $5.5 million this year and $6.5 million next year. He's guaranteed to make, you know, $12 million in his first 2 years. And considering that he's really good, he gets to make almost eight, then almost 10. And in the years after that, he's making more in his first 4 years than I think McHale made in his entire career by far. So, you know, that's, again, the beauty of the league. That's, you've set the future up where the league is so good. Hey, when they started playing those guys, that was the days of tape delay, and they brought that up. And I love the big highlighted recorded earlier on the bottom of the screen during the interview. Yeah. Like, that's, can you imagine watching a playoff game now at 8 p.m. that was played 3 hours ago? That I it's ridiculous, but
I tell you, I was 11, 12, 13 years old in the early 80s, and I remember becoming a huge basketball fan late 70s. But the first Celtics team I remember was the horrible one the year after Havlicek retired, you know, Rowan Wicks and all those guys. And that was sort of the nadir of the league, the bottom. And I remember watching, wasn't the Lakers-Sixers, but it was the other Lakers championship, I guess, 82, where the game didn't air when I was growing up until the 11 o'clock news. So whatever game it was of that 82 Sixers Lakers series, I think it was the one James Worthy broke his leg, actually. That wasn't on the news, on television, until 11:30 at night where I grew up. So it's so unfathomable now, because you have generations of kids and fans nowadays who, you know, they spend their day anticipating that tip off to the Cavaliers, you know, game four of the Cavaliers Warriors series, or whatever it happens to be, the big series deep in the playoffs that's going on. And it's such a, TV ratings are so good, and it's such a must see event for a sports fan that it's hard to fathom that it was something that took a back seat to Sunday afternoon programming, you know, 35 years ago.
I feel like we should be doing this podcast in rocking chairs on a porch drinking lemonade.
Right.
Because I was, I remember when I was a kid, I couldn't stay up to watch the news. So I had to hope that the West Coast games were over early enough where the scores made the early edition of the paper. And they often didn't. I remember opening up the newspaper, which for younger listeners was a large sheet of, the morning paper would have your scores, you know, Cleveland, Knicks, and blah, 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 blah. And then you would have your West Coast games and it would just say late next to it. And you're just like, oh man. So the Celtics would be in LA playing the Lakers, and it wouldn't be until 2 or 3 the next afternoon when the evening edition of, for me, the Providence Journal or the Pawtucket Times would come out, and you'd have to buy a second version of that day's newspaper to open up to the sports page and go, oh, we lost or whatever. You know, like that was, and then you'd have to, sometimes you just never got to see the highlights. It just never worked out. So wild time. Now you don't even have to watch the game. You could watch just on Twitter and people will tweet out the highlights and you'll get an entire game flow. All right, back to this episode. The first thing that jumped out at me was a story I didn't even know about Larry Bird. Before he came to the Celtics, he was playing baseball and a short hop ruined his finger. And to hear him say, the ball never felt right to me in the pros. I always liked the way the ball felt in my hand better in college. I can't wrap my head around that, because Larry Bird was obviously one of the best shooters we've ever seen. And to think like, oh yeah, I didn't have a real great feel for the ball. How can you say that to me now and put that thought in my head that you liked the way the ball felt when you were in college, but your finger got busted and you dealt with
it. Yeah, it's pretty crazy, isn't it? It's hard to fathom that he actually had a better feel for shooting at one point than he did in the NBA. But hey, I've heard that before, and then he mangled that finger playing softball. And you know, you look at his hands now and his digits are pointing in all different directions. He looks like an offensive lineman's hands a little bit. So the amazing thing about that was that I think he put it like, yeah, I had to make a little bit of an adjustment to my shot. Not many guys, I can't think of many players who would sort of be able to do that calculus in their head to figure out, all right, I mangled this finger. My shot is off this way. This is what I need to do to fix it. But he did and repaired it to a point where it's as good as anybody's shot we've probably ever seen, and yet wasn't good enough for him compared to the Indiana State jumper.
So Bird comes into the league, and I'll jump around a little bit to get a little more chronological, and he talks about being all right. Like he comes into camp and he gets tested and he realizes like, you know, I did okay and I'll be all right. Now that is the Cedric Maxwell story, right? Where Maxwell came up and tested him and Bird just started hitting threes over his, you know, right in his face.
Yeah, I don't know that. I didn't know who he was talking about specifically when he said, I remember he said he called his high school coach or his college coach and he said, yeah, I'm going to have a really good year. This was his rookie year. And he called them because he had played against some of the veterans on the team. But he made a point to say a couple of times that they weren't in really good shape. And I was trying to figure out who he meant specifically. That would line up to be Max, though.
I feel like this is the story where he reported to camp. And this was, to hear Max tell it, this was the you know, oh, here comes the great white hope. And it was basically Sidney Wicks and Curtis Rowe. And they were not in great shape. That's the story that I've always heard. And then basically they were just gone. Like they ended up getting cut. And then Maxwell's like, well, let me give this, you know, this white boy a shot. And then, you know, Bird hits a shot and he goes, oh, okay, that was a good shot. Now let me really try to check him. And then Bird hits another shot and goes, all right, let's try this. And then hits another shot and he goes, damn, this white boy's going to be good. And I think that's like the story that was kind of left out. Like if that's where you would edit in Maxwell's story, but I have heard Maxwell tell that story, which is hilarious because Bird comes in and is just like, yeah, whatever.
Right. Pretty accomplished young player at that point too, Max. I mean, I feel like
with that cast of characters they had on that team, I suppose it was possible that he could have gone either way. He could have ended up being the player that he became. And in my mind, one of the really underrated Celtics of the 80s, because he was as responsible as anyone for putting up, kind of gets overlooked because people love the 86 team with Walton so much. And Bird McHale agreed that was the best team they ever played on. But it's not, I think it's mm-hmm. a credit to Max that he got out from under that group of miscreants that they had post Havlicek and before Bird, and that, you know, only took 3 or 4 shots being buried in his face for him to realize how good Bird actually was and to get on board with what they were doing.
Yeah. And now my favorite stretch of this whole thing, and the part where I was just completely mesmerized, it's not just the stories of these guys talking to each other, which is always fun. Whenever old teammates get together, they end up just reverting back to the, hey, remember that time? And hey, remember that time? And that's always fun. But Bird talking about becoming a playmaker and being, you know, how Kevin McHale liked to get the pass. You know, McHale said, you always had this knack where I could hold a guy off with my right hand. You always put it right in my left hand.
Yes.
And Bird was like, yeah, I knew if I put it right there, it would just get you right into that little baby hook in the lane. And when it was Robert Parrish, I had to put a little bit in front of him because Robert Parrish liked to go get it, you know, and you had to get that ball up high. And that whole thing was a very nice insight into how his brain worked. And the fact that Larry Bird knew very quickly, early on in his career, like in high school, that he was very good at figuring out his teammates. And that might be what made him as great as he was, because on top of being able to hit shots in people's face and tell Xavier McDaniel, I'm going to hit this in your face, and then doing it, he was able to know, like, okay, Kevin likes it like this, Parrish likes it like this, I got DJ doing this, I got Ainge who likes to shoot the three, and all of that stuff, and learning a step back jumper from a teammate that we've never heard of, like, all of that stuff was just fascinating to me.
Yeah, that was one of the things I really liked about it too, that was kind of not necessarily a deep dive. I mean, you got all you wanted about Bird and McHale, obviously, two of the big superstars. And they talk about Chief and DJ and Danny a little bit, and the guys you remember really well. Walton, there's a little segment about him, but they get into like ML Carr and how revered he was. And, you know, people under 20, 25 years old here probably think of him as the guy who tanked the 97 Celtics, you know, tried to get the Tim Duncan pick and not having it worked out. They don't realize that he was an absolute bulldog of a player who brought a real winning attitude here when he came over from Detroit. So clear, McHale and Bird really think a lot of him and how he helped them early in their career. The guy that Bird took a step back from was Terry Durod, who is a garbage time all-star, a little guard, came in, fired up jumpers, would have been a probably a more useful player had his career happened a little bit later, because he had really good range. He could have been a three-point specialist, you know, like a Craig Hodges type, maybe not the good of a shooter, but a similar skill set. And he used to play Bird and McHale and any takers in a while, just bury shots in their face. And, you know, told you that Bird and McHale, too, were always watching, always paying attention, always trying to find some little thing that they could take and implement and add to their own game, even if it came from the 12th man on the roster who was, you know, out there to check up 4 jumpers in the last 45 seconds of a blowout. That was really impressive to me that guys, players of their magnitude, still looked around and tried to find things that would help them, no matter whether it came from a superstar or some guy deep down the bench like Durod.
Who was that he said was his favorite teammate?
Oh, man.
I don't remember.
McHale or Bird?
A Bird. Well, he'd always said that DJ was his favorite team, but I forget.
Yes.
Trying to totally drew ML? A blank. Yeah, it might have been ML. He just appreciated like the drive. I think it was ML. And it just it goes to the whole point where these guys, it's not just thinking about themselves. They understand, like Bird knows he's better than everybody on the floor. He always knew it. And within a very short time in getting into the pros. He knew he could do basically whatever he wanted. Side note, I think it was really interesting that he said that it was almost easier in the pros to get the stuff off that he wanted, because in college he kept getting double and triple teamed. And I just never really thought of it that way. And in the pros, everybody had to be guarded, and it suddenly became a little bit easier. Just, I thought that particular part was interesting, but just the depth of how they saw the game, and we don't, I think, outside of it, understand how deeply these players, and it still applies to these guys today. You know, when you hear Kevin Garnett's the first guy I heard call it a craft. And since then, I think it's caught on. I don't even know if he made that up or stole it from anybody, but you have to understand so many different things. And Bird talked about it when you're drawing up a play, like you drew up a play, and it wasn't just about executing what was on the whiteboard. It was also understanding, like, you had to ad lib at the same time, because you went out there with Bill Fitch saying, this guy goes here, this guy goes there, you go here, and this is where the pass goes. But then the defense does something completely different, and everybody has to be so intensely knowledgeable that you at the same time have to understand, oh, I know Maxwell is going to cut back door, and I see it, and I think he sees it, and if I see him, the second I see him twitch, I'm putting the ball where he's going to go get it. And that, to me, just goes to show, again, depth of knowledge of the game.
Yeah, it reminded me of what Tom Brady and the Patriots receivers do, where if the cornerback shoulder is turned slightly to the left, then you're breaking off your in route and you're going to the flat, you know, whatever it is. And they all have to read it the same way. And as Bird was talking about this during the interview and the documentary, or whatever you want to call it, they showed footage of him taking an inbounds pass. He's the inbounder on the sideline, and he's just scanning. You know, like you see him looking around the court, seeing, okay, who's where, who's doing what, is there a mismatch, maybe making eye contact with a guy to sort of connect, you know, go back to our Max, or, you know, you can get the angle inside, you know, on this guy, Mikhail. And it's nothing new to us. We know that Larry had that capability, but it's just a fascinating different kind of level to hear Bird and Mikhail, who was the guy on the receiving end of so many of those passes and who was making that mental connection with Bird so often before those plays unfolded, to hear them talk about it and sort of, you know, what they saw in the moment, what they connected on in the moment. And even as you mentioned before, the little nitty gritty details of how Bird would put the ball in Mikhail's right hand to lead him directly into the layup or something like that. It's just what they do. And what they did is it was incredible, right? But to know the depths of it and to know the intricate details of how they actually did what they did, and to hear these two guys talking about it and reminiscing about it 30 years, 35 years after the fact, I was hoping this interview was going to be awesome, and it was beyond my expectations.
Yeah, absolutely. I am such a basketball nerd that just thinking about them talking about, like, I literally, my adrenaline starts to pump. Like my heart starts beating faster when I hear these things. It really is like falling in love with that moment all over again. And it happens whenever the greats are talking about the things that they see. Because look, I've played basketball. I was pretty successful at it from, you know, just in comparison to the general public. And just to see how much I really don't know about the game is like, I love it. I love it because I feel like I know a bunch. I feel like I've done pretty well and I know a lot about basketball. And it's like saying I'm a college science professor and these are a bunch of Albert Einsteins walking around. Like, that's the difference. Like, these are, you know, the Elon Musk, you know, the friggin', like, what? Like, you saw, wow, that's amazing. I love hearing all of that stuff. I could sit there and listen to him talk about the intricacies of how he throws a pass for an hour alone, just like that. So Another thing I was a little bit surprised, you know, and maybe not, because I remember being nervous before games, and I remember the stories of Bill Russell, Jesus Christ, Bill Russell always throwing up before a game.
Yeah, yeah.
Players are nervous. And Bird said, I was so nervous before the games, I couldn't wait until they started. But there's this element of anticipation, and the butterflies happen, and then getting on the court and you go, oh, okay, here we go. Just stepping between the lines. I love that because it just highlights a couple of things. First of all, that Bird, despite all of his greatness, is human. And as a human being, before a major event and you step out in front of 20,000 people, yeah, you get nervous. Like they all do. And maybe some guys in today's game might not admit it, but there are butterflies before games. But also just the zen of being between those lines. And when we hear, like last year, when we heard Isaiah Thomas after the tragedy of his sister, you talk about the basketball court ends up being your sanctuary. And just that to highlight, I like that conversation because it highlighted that humanity, but also just he belonged on that court. And these guys belong there. And just stepping on there and getting into layup lines became this natural, okay, everything's going to be fine. I'm dribbling a ball. I'm putting it through the hoop. We're fine. We're good.
Yeah, it was a happy place for both of them, right? I guess maybe part of it's when you're so awesome at something that you're going to find your comfort there, and both of them were. I mean, they both obviously worked incredibly, incredibly hard for that too. But yeah, I think in life you want to get to that level with anything that you do, where you find this one thing that you're so comfortable at and so good at and so find so personally satisfying that when you're doing it, you're in a, you're almost like in the zone, you know, almost, just at ease and poised and all those things that maybe in other aspects of your life, you struggle to find sometimes, you know. Larry never really was thrilled to talk with the media. He was good with guys he knew and, you know, Jackie McMullen, other reporters he knew very well, Shaughnessy, Bob Ryan, but other times he didn't want to talk. But if you asked him about something specific, like we just saw this interview about something that happened on the basketball court, he would have a 100% recall of what happened and what he was thinking and what he saw three steps of ahead of what any of the rest of us saw. And it's just, I mean, the word for it is genius. And of course, when you're a genius at something, of course, that's going to be the place where you're the happiest in the world. You don't just get to be good at it because you're skilled. You get to be good at it because you love it and you're passionate about it and you worked really hard. Success.
Yeah. We're going to end this podcast on the ending of their careers that they talked about, where that moment of, and they each said it, there's a moment of, what am I doing? Where the just pounding. And it's just, you put your body, as great as they are, again, this is the humanity. And one of my ongoing things, I've always tried to focus on humanizing these players, because I think it's so important for fans to understand the humanity behind the greatness, that they're not just robots out there. They're not video game sprites that have just energy bars that, you know, when they get a little bit low energy, you sit them down and you get that bar back up, and they're not human. They are human beings that have real issues, real repercussions. It's something as, you know, cosmetic as the finger bending the wrong way and you deal with it for the rest of your life. Or like Kevin McHale played through a broken foot and he's just never going to walk the same again. To see these guys talk, there's a little bit of sadness, and there's that saying that every athlete dies twice. You know, once when he dies, when he retires, you could see a little bit of that in just the pain of not being able to do what you've done, and that kind of realization of like, man, this thing that I've loved to do my entire life, my calling, my passion, the thing that's brought me the most joy, and that's given me the greatest notoriety, it's going away, and I have to come to grips with that. That's hard to do.
It is, yeah. I mean, it must really suck when you're so good at something like they were, and then it starts slowly falling apart on you, whether because you're just getting older or physically injuries are starting to intervene and becoming harder and harder to overcome. That's what happened to both those guys. It was interesting, though, John, because the Larry was talking about that. Mikhail was talking. I think they segued into it by talking about the teams that they played on, the best team they played on, and then the team they played on that they thought should have won. And, you know, both agreed 86 was the best. Bird thought 87 or 85 was the team that should have won and didn't. Mikhail said 82, but that's when Mikhail started having his foot injuries. And this sort of led into them talking about how the end was coming and how they were ready to go, but because of the frustrations and the pain by the time the retirement did come. It was really interesting to hear Bird say when he got off that podium after formally announcing his retirement, he felt like the weight of the world lifted off his shoulders. You'd think it would be this enormous moment of sadness. It's something I've done my whole life, but it had become such a burden to him at that point because of the back issues and the heel issues and everything he dealt with that when he was done, he found himself happy that he was done. It was really remarkable to hear him talk about that.
Yeah. That I feel like is rare because you're more likely to have like, what's his name? Brad Miller. Remember Brad Miller crying on the bench?
Big guy.
Yeah, big guy. I think it was at Sacramento at the time. And he knew his career was over. And now it's Brad Miller. Like he had a nice career, certainly a nice career, long career. But he didn't want it to end. And that, to me, was, you talk about human moments, sitting there crying on the bench, knowing, like, this is it. I'm never going to be in the locker room again. And never going to be hanging around with these guys again. And that's honestly the thing that makes them hang around too long. Guys that hang around, maybe you say, why is he still going? Why doesn't he retire on top? And people want that grand storyline of you just won a title and you know, go ahead. This is your chance to ride off into the sunset. No,
yeah.
No, nobody wants that. Nobody wants that. I'm 44 and I would give anything to have another year in a locker room playing ball with those guys. I don't want to go through the pounding. I don't want to go sit there on a training table anymore. But you know what I want to do? I want to ride to practice. I want to be in the locker room. I want to be stretching with those guys. I want to be traveling with those guys. That's the stuff that most of these guys miss. It's that camaraderie, that family, that fun, that youthfulness. And to have your body betray you and take that away is that might be the hardest thing. I'm surprised that Bird handled it as well as he did, but Bird's just a different character.
Just tells you how heavy it became for him to know that he was.
No, it's true.
He wasn't going to play at the level that he wanted to play at, and it all the work that he had to put in, all the physical therapy he had to put in, just to get out there, just to be able to stand upright for 32 minutes a game, whatever he was playing at that point, was just became too much. But the thing, those guys. I mean, in the end, they decided, okay, I'm walking away. A lot of guys don't even have that, don't even get what Brad Miller got, which is to know that their time was up. A lot of guys, they just don't get a job the next year. All of a sudden, nobody wants you anymore. And I guess there's maybe some satisfaction in that for them, that even though they were ravaged by injuries, they ultimately got to determine when their careers were ending.
Mm-hmm. And I will add to that. I think there's a respect for the game that they have, and I think point. Bird especially, but I think to hear Bird say, I couldn't do what I wanted to do anymore or what I needed to do on the court, that is if I'm not going to be helping my teammates, if I'm not going to be putting out the best possible basketball I can play, then there's no point in me doing it and hanging on. Even some guys, they have personal, like I said, the personal thing, they say, I'm going to stick around. But for Bird, who played at a super high level, if he couldn't give the game what the game needed, then I think he'd had enough respect for the game and for his teammates to say, I can't give it to you the way I want to and the way you deserve to have it. So I got to go.
Yeah. Imagine if he'd hung around like Chief did, played till he was 45 or whatever.
Oh, man. I don't know. They would have had to.
That was him.
you know, just robotic exoskeletons to get him out there playing. Well, I think that's a good place to end it. I really appreciate, you know, you taking a little bit of time and late on the Tuesday night for our Wednesday show. Look, this is my favorite thing to talk about, Larry Bird and the glory days. And you wrote a great piece in the Globe covering this. And I know this is kind of your wheelhouse too. So I appreciate you,
yes, sir.
appreciate you taking the time out to talk about this with me.
I'll talk about those guys 24/7.
It's great stuff. And it's, I think the history is really important to relive, and it's just so much fun. So again, thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Glad to come on with you.
Just another great conversation with Chad Finn about a topic that I just love. Old school Celtics, Larry Bird, Kevin McHale, just talking basketball at the highest of levels, but with a human side to it. Just like the show wasn't long enough, I could have talked to Chad Finn for a lot longer, but had to keep it to a manageable level. So, but follow Chad Finn on Twitter, because he's got, he's just a great follow on Twitter. It's @GlobeChadFinn. And if you are a new listener, if you're one of Chad's followers, follow me on Twitter @RedsArmy_John and follow the show on Twitter @Rainin_Jays. So Rainin, no G, _JS. So if you follow me, I'll just be retweeting everything anyway. And if you like that show, just know that we're talking Celtics all the time on this show. It's 5 days a week. And once the games start up, we'll be doing post-game podcasts. We're here for you Monday through Friday. So subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Search for Locked On Celtics and subscribe to the show so you get it directly to your phone or your app or whatever it is. Wherever you get your podcast, it'll be there right away. And oh, I hope you enjoy the show. If you are a subscriber, again, a 5-star rating would be amazing. A good review would be amazing. But most importantly, share the podcast and spread the word. Let everyone know, please, to listen to the Locked On Celtics podcast. We are part of the Locked On Podcast Network.